Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
My best mate, he's American, born and raised, and he says that after Halloween is when it's acceptable to start playing Christmas songs, which I don't agree with at all.
I like a similar sort of
Christmas for December.
Yeah, in the UK, but I'm not even sure how interesting the conversation is about when you should play Christmas songs. It seems to be an obsession by a lot of people.
Yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things. For me, I like it because it gives us something to look forward to at the end of November, and then it, you know, keeps the kids from constantly asking for stuff for Christmas at the end of September.
How many kids have you got?
I've got two. I've got a daughter who's 8 and a son who's 5. Cool. And so, yeah. It's I don't know how qualified I am to be a dad, but they're still alive and they've got all the digits on their hands. So here we are.
40 people coming over to celebrate with you. That's pretty significant.
My wife, she has my mother-in-law has three siblings and my father-in-law has 5, so cousins and what have you, people dip in and out. We kind of have an open house. Dinner will be served at 4. Everyone brings, we assign a dish for everyone to bring, and we just kind of have an open door all day.
What's sort of typical for a Thanksgiving meal?
Turkey, mashed potatoes, gravy. This
is
thing
it
they
gravy
call
green... the traditional gravy.
Well,
or is it something else?
Well, yeah, it is. Like my understanding, well, what I make is an English version without the gravy browning. Is what we have made of the turkey juices. And sorry to all the vegetarians and vegans out there, but that's what the gravy's made of. And the green what they call green bean casserole, which is green beans in like a mushroom sauce with crispy fried onions on the top. In the South,
sounds good. Sounds really good.
Yeah, that is good. In the South, they make what they call collard greens, which are I don't even like. It's like a really bitter cabbage, and they boil it with ham hock, and then they sweet potato pie. So they'll make, you know, like sweet potatoes in a pie with marshmallows on the top. I can't get on board with that. I'm not.
That doesn't sound good at all.
And then a lot of families have their own dishes. My wife's family adds sour cream, and the mashed potatoes are ridiculous. I swear it's 2,000 calories a scoop.
That's okay,
swims in butter. Yeah, it's great.
Once every now and then. We had mashed potatoes last night, and my missus makes fucking amazing mashed potato. She does, and she's like with butter, and she'll reduce the butter. It's just lovely, right?
Oh, yep.
But I'm like, should we put a bit of cheese in there as well? She's like, no, you fucking don't. But isn't it like indulgent enough?
My wife poaches garlic in it, like sour cream, butter, and then she poaches garlic in the milk. The garlic gets soft. She mashes it down, smashes it in there, and she makes. Like so much, honestly, it's a ridiculous day for food. But you know, like you said, once in a while, Yeah,
sounds fun.
It's really...
I'd like to come to America and have Thanksgiving with a family. That would be an amazing experience.
I have a two bedroom granny flat off the back of my house. You're welcome.
You've got an annex.
Yeah. So
whereabouts do you live, Matt?
Sacramento, California. So if you know where people know where San Francisco is, we're 60 miles from San Francisco. Sacramento is the state capital.
Is Sacramento a affluent place to live?
No, it has its poor areas, it has its wealthy areas. It's the state capital, so it's full of government workers. So we don't have extreme poverty, although I'm sure someone in the fighting cock will call me up on that, because there is poverty around here. Obviously there is. But you know, with government workers, nobody makes minimum wage, but there aren't many millionaires either. So it's a middle class area. It's a government city.
When Schwarzenegger was the governor of California, did he live in Sacramento?
No, that was a lot of the consternation. No, he lives down south, but he would fly up in a helicopter.
All right, so he never actually lived in California.
Well, they have a governor's mansion, so he would stay here. But I think his family still live down south. My wife used to work at Starbucks when she was at university, and she served him Starbucks every morning when he was on his way to the Capitol to do whatever it was that Governor Schwarzenegger did. she met him loads of times.
If you remember, you might not remember this actually, but in the UK there was like a tourist sort of come to California. It's fantastic. Look at us. We kick hacky sacks up in the air and we play guitars next to fucking campfires and whatnot. So they were sort of selling California as a tourist destination, and Arnold Schwarzenegger was in this advert.
Yep.
But you're saying he didn't actually live there?
No, he lived in California. He just didn't live in Sacramento.
South of where you live. Okay, I understand.
Yeah.
When you say, so it's weird. It, 8 hours, fucking hell. Like, when you say that to an Englishman, when you say south, what I think is south of the country, or in your case, the continent. So I'm thinking he lives in Texas or somewhere like that. No.
So California is called down the west. Is down the longest state down the west coast. So he lived I think he lived in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is 600 and something miles from where I am, and it takes a long time to drive. So
moved to America, did it shock you, or was you prepared for the size of it? Like, because everyone can sit, look at a map, but it's different when in the everyday practical, just living practically, everybody seems just fucking miles from everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it was mental, because obviously we speak the same language, and a lot of the history, the two countries' histories are intertwined, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but whatever. But there's a lot of culture shock, a ton of culture shock that took me 4 or 5 years to really kind of wrap my head around, and then about a decade to just get to a point where I made peace with it. And I just, you know, I don't bring my, I, you know, everyone on the in the Telegram group would say I'm a full-on Yank now, compared to a lot of the mentality of the way British people or English people, whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
I had a lot of culture, but everything's massive, and it truly is. Everything's big. Like, a tiny car here would be a Ford Focus, which is a family car in England. Even just little things like that. Like, why do you drive a massive truck? Well, it's really practical, because now I don't have to call anyone who's got a white van man. And and everything is miles away. You know, there's not a huge amount of public transport. There's not a huge amount of infrastructure. There are very few trains. If you go to San Francisco, there's a train and there's a tram system that goes around the Bay Area. But where I live, there's a tram system, but there's no car park at the tram station. So, like, wanted to, it's a really big place. You know, it takes 5 hours, sometimes 6 hours, to fly from one side of the country to the other. You know, people are like, well, why do Americans never leave America to go on holiday?
Well, so fucking, just to get to an airport that serves a European destination, you have to travel six. I would never leave. Right, so, I don't think I'd ever leave. I couldn't be asked.
Yeah, I mean, so you know, you fly 6 hours from Heathrow in any direction and you're pretty much in a different continent.
Yeah, you're anywhere you want to be. And certainly, like, if you're going east, you can get into Asia in 6 hours. Like, if you're going to Turkey, you can get into Asia in 6 hours. Definitely.
Yeah,
Middle East, you can get to Africa.
So it's a really big place. But I like it here. There is things I'd change, like anyone. But when I travel home to England now, because I've been in America 15 years, I'm like, God damn it! Why do people do things like that here? This is so annoying.
I think that's a nice segue, Matt, because the point of this podcast is to welcome to No Holds Barred podcast, by the way, Matt. And
thanks, mate. Hopefully this isn't boring and self-indulgent and narcissistic. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm a little bit nervous.
I asked you. It wasn't like you came to me and asked. But, the people in the Telegram group and whatever, the various WhatsApp groups seem to have sprung up since we created the Telegram group. And for people who are listening to this who don't know what the Fighting Cock is and just listening to this podcast, don't worry about any of that, because it's not interesting. It's not important to this conversation. Anyway, Matt, people were saying that you have an interesting job. Like, what right now? What is your job? And then after you explain that, I want to go back to the beginning of how you ended up where you were, because we had a phone conversation where you explained that, and that was really interesting. So what do you do right now, and why would I be interested in that, and why would other people be interested in it?
Well, I mean, I don't think the actual job itself is particularly interesting. I work for a large bank, and I help people when they want to buy a house or remortgage. In America, you call it refinancing. So, you know, I help people with the financing of pretty much most people's biggest purchase. You know, the thing they spend the most money on in their life.
Houses.
Yeah, you know, houses. Yeah. So that's what I do.
And when you say you help people, it's not me you're going to help. You might do. You know, I am. Yeah. You know, I'm a bloody successful gentleman, but I'm not. I'm probably not going to enter your radar.
Well, I mean, I will. I will help anyone, because that's just my personality. I don't have ideas above my station.
All right, I know, I understand that, and you're a nice guy, Matt. But how rich are the people that you're working with? How rich?
A lot of them are mega rich. A lot of them have what we would call in American net worths of 5 to 150 million.
And these might be sports stars. They might be bankers. They might what?
Yeah,
what?
Yeah. So it's a few of them are professional athletes. A few people, people who have startup business. I live near San Francisco, so you end up running into people that, starting a lot of the apps that you have on your phone emanated from Silicon Valley.
A lot of tech startup and that kind of thing. Like, quickly before we sort of go back to what you do, is like, what Silicon Valley is, what and why is there so much money there?
Silicon Valley is an area just south of San Francisco, and it's where companies like Apple, Hewlett Packard, Oracle, Twitter.
So anything
anything other than Microsoft from Seattle. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so they attract a lot of very clever computer engineering people. Stanford University is there. I don't know if that's a famous name in the UK, but
it is.
So Stanford University is in that area. And so it kind of became a hub in the late 70s and 80s for tech people to come together. And there's not a lot of space there. So it creates, they made a lot of wealth, and then,
So someone really rich from Silicon Valley who's made a lot of money on Twitter or in some sort of social media or some sort of tech development, whatever it might be, blockchain, whatever it is.
Yeah.
They have lots of money, and they come to someone like you to do what? You said like high sort of the biggest purchases that they might make in their life, which
for these guys. So, a lot of these people are considered really wealthy. Now, I don't work with people like Jeff Bezos from Amazon. Like, that's you know. But
that's
a lot of these people,
stratosphere, isn't it?
Right, but a lot of these people, they're known as being wealthy, but a lot of their money is tied up in the stock of the company that they started. And so when you, they have what we call capital gains. So when you sell the stock, if you bought the stock for a dollar and now it's worth $10 a share, and you sell, I don't know, $5 million worth of the stock, you owe the government taxes, and in California, the state of California taxes on the difference between the dollar you paid for the stock and the $10 that you sold the stock for. So if you're paying 30% or 25% taxes on that $9 gain, you're giving a lot of money to Uncle Sam, which is what we call the tax man here.
Yeah.
So when they want to do a big purchase like a house, $5 or $10 or $20 million, if sell $20 million worth of stock, they actually probably have to sell something closer to $28 million of stock, give the government $8 million in taxes, and the seller of the house $20 million. So then bankers like myself come in and say, okay, rather than buying the house all in cash, how about we put a mortgage on the house? It reduces the amount of stock you have to sell to buy the house. You give the government a lot less money, if any at all, and you get the house you want, and the cost of borrowing the money is less than the taxes that you would have paid to the government. And right. That's a very, very basic conversation, very basic
so
reason.
You're sort
why
of like a high-end accountant, right?
No, that every accountant on the face of planet Earth would stab me in the side of the face if I even started to claim something like that. No, I just I provide them a way of, you know, borrowing money while it's very, very cheap, and then not paying so much in taxes on that money. Eventually, they'll pay taxes on that money, but if you spread it out over time, you can pay less taxes. It's just a way that wealthy people are able to, you know, keep more of the money that they've earned or gained or inherited or whatever the right, you know, way they got their money.
It's fair to say that if you're, and I think fundamentally what this podcast is about money, I think you understand it more than I do, because you have to make decisions and give advice to people who have lots of money,
right,
who want to do things that the normal person does, it's not relevant to them because they don't have enough money for it to impact them.
Right.
That's fair to say, isn't it? So,
I think so, yeah.
So is it true then that if you make money, if you have money, it's a lot easier to make money?
I think so. When we were talking the other day, when you have money, it removes so much stress and anxiety from, you know, your day-to-day living, right? You're not worried about whether your car will work to get you to work. You're not worried about losing your job because, you know, you can't afford new tires on your car and they're bald. You can't, you know, you're not worried about putting food on the table. You can eat a healthier lifestyle. So yeah, I think, and all of that then sets you up to focus on making money.
Yeah, the bills. So you don't worry, you don't have to expend energy on worrying about whether or not you can afford to pay your phone bill, which you need to communicate with people that you love, or
yeah, absolutely,
or the rent, just to be able to pay the rent. So I think about my feeling about having money is not worrying, or the luxury of not worrying about how do I pay my bills.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest things that I've learned over the last 10, 12, 15 years of doing what I'm doing is exactly that. It's not the luxuries of the stuff you can buy, you know, nice cars, houses, watches, you know, artwork, whatever. It's the fact that not once do you ever have to worry about whether your child has a balanced diet, whether they can concentrate in school and therefore get good grades so they don't repeat the cycle of poverty, if you will.
Yeah.
Even little things like not worrying about having good internet access. You know, in the 21st century, you can't operate without internet access. I think it's, to me, you know, clean air, clean water, roof over your head, clothing on your back. For me, healthcare, a basic human rights. And I would say in 2021, access to the internet is getting very 100%. Close to being one of those things, right?
No, 100%. 100%. I would agree with that. without.
And so so having money, or you know, always having an emergency fund. Yeah, it's not just, like I said, it's not just about having the money. It's the freedom that it gives you to then concentrate on doing other things. It's a massive privilege. I don't think a lot of people necessarily think about things like that, and not thinking about, like you said. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who's in recent times, apologies if you can hear my dog drinking water in the background.
No.
I think when you listen back, you might be able to hear it. My dog, he's got a problem with his skin, and we've had to put him on steroids from the vet, so it makes him really thirsty. Bless him.
Don't worry.
So but it's very, very relatively recently in my life that I don't have to worry about where the bills are, you know, how to pay the bills, or Christmas is coming and the kids want certain things and we can't afford it. Like, luckily now at 40, I'm in a situation where I don't have to worry. I can spend things without worrying about rent, right? Or I can afford to buy a new car if I want to, not outright, but in over, you know, leasing it. I can do those things. And the greatest gratification or feeling of comfort that I get or from those things doesn't compare to being able to not worry about my bills. And that's right. What I feel like with money and society, that it's people who don't have a lot think that buying, actually, fuck, I'm not going to say that. That's a stupid thing to say.
I know where you were going with that, with that statement. I think one of the things that excites me, I think one of the things that prompted this conversation in the first place was we were chatting about crypto and
how it is.
I mean, it's a big problem. I say big problem. It's a very challenging, what I would call, asset class for people like me to deal with, because it's so deregulated. And what I do for a living is so, so closely watched by the government and regulators that crypto just blows everything out of the ground. But I'm seeing people who previously had really struggled to be able to, you know, like you said, pay the bills, have, you know, remove anxiety from their life and stress, which ultimately causes other health issues and so on and so forth. Things like crypto, and I'm not a crypto expert, but I know enough, I think, probably to be dangerous. Crypto is putting money in people's pockets that they've never had before. I think
What I would say is, but in order to, that's correct. Like, in terms of, certainly if you get on board at the right time.
Yeah.
But in order to benefit from crypto, if anyone is ever going to properly benefit from crypto, and we're not talking about the people that made fucking hundreds of millions of pounds off Bitcoin because they were there in 2013. So people that are interested now, you need disposable income to make that happen. And that doesn't mean £100. I think there's this misunderstanding that if you have £100 and you put it into the right coin, although that is still true, but you have to, it's like winning the lottery, or it's not like winning the lottery. It's like winning an accumulator, right? Where the return off a pound is sort of 20 or 30 grand. But if you're playing crypto, like you want to see a decent return, you need to put significant amounts in. And when we talked before recording, was that I had that money at the start of last year, where things started to pick up for us, for people who are into crypto, I say us.
Yeah.
For people who are into crypto, it started to pick up. I had the money in the first place to do it, whereas previously I didn't. And that's why I think that conversation about having cash spare after you've paid the rent and whatnot, that's how you can make money, or that's one example of how you can make money, I guess. I think that's where that conversation came from.
Yeah, it's a very fair point. And, like, you know, it's the age-old adage of, it's easy to make money when you've got money, and I see all day, every day. Yeah. And when crypto first kind of hit the main channels was in 2018, when Bitcoin first went on its run to like 20 grand, and I was sat there scratching my head because I've always been taught financially don't understand it.
Did you have money?
No, mate. No, I had money to put in it, but I didn't. but mainly, you know, for, like I was always taught, if you don't understand it, don't invest in it. Yeah. And that's a very Warren Buffett principle. And so
Warren Buffett, for those that don't know, he's the massively
one of the richest
successful
blokes in the world, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. just a bit.
I mean, he's 90 something years old and he's only ever invested in stocks, and he looks for what he thinks are undervalued companies and he buys them, and then they go up in value, and he's made himself a massive billionaire. And one of his principles is if you don't understand it, don't invest in it. And he'd now come out and said that he's made some mistakes along the way by not investing in certain things because he didn't understand it. But
he remains one of the richest people on earth.
He still remains. Exactly. I didn't get in 2018. I got in, actually, from what you said, about the same time as you, where I finally got comfortable that Bitcoin and another coin called Ethereum were gaining enough, I don't want to use the word stability because they're not stable, but they were gaining enough foothold. And when I start reading, this is going to make me sound like a total nerd, but when I read business websites and you see mainstream banks commenting on things like cryptocurrencies, then you start to think, okay, well, they want to sink their teeth into it. That's going to create an underlying level of stability in it. And therefore, like you just said, I had some, I say spare cash. I had a little bit of money on the side that wasn't doing much with. So I threw it in there and, you know, I've made a little bit of a rate of return. But like you said, it's not just, I didn't make millions off of $100 in the cycle.
No, you can't. It's too late for that. It's too late. Yeah. But there are coins out there, and it's, we can't go into it now because it's too complicated. But like, there are people making lots of money on shit coins and creating coins and building. It's all about marketing now, and it's a different beast. But there is a parallel between Warren Buffett and you, Matt. And that would be that you saw opportunity, you saw something that you understood and you thought, I could do that. So if we go back to, if I remember it rightly, you was in the UK and you married and moved to the US and you had to get a job. Right, so what...
That's exactly it.
Go on, tell me your story from the UK.
Yeah, so what? I mean, I was in the UK. I was working for charity. They offered me the chance to do some training in Denver. And I was 18, 19 at the time. I deferred my place to university. And so I had some time to go and travel. And so I thought, I'll go. Went to Denver, met a girl, settled down, you know, the age old song lyric. Got married, I think, culturally relatively young compared to what people would expect.
How
people I got married.
How old was you?
I was 21.
Is that young in America or is that just young here in the UK?
No, I think it's young in America now. Yeah. Mm. And so I, you know, at that time when we got married, I literally had $280 in the entire world. And looking back, I don't know.
You're telling the story, you know, but I don't know this story. So you've met a girl, in the UK. She's from
I came to Denver. I met
Apologies.
Her when I was in Denver.
That's
in Denver.
The charity gave you an opportunity to go and learn elsewhere. So you met this girl in Denver, and you're a very handsome Englishman in Denver, and that would be a rarity.
My accent, I wouldn't put handsome. I think my accent is what American people tend to appreciate people with different accents. So that stood out.
You are what you think. So, all right. So an average looking man goes to Denver with an English accent.
And I worked for a charity and we'd done some work in the third world. I worked in orphanages in Romania and Ukraine before they joined the EU when having an orphanage system was outlawed. My wife had been in Bolivia. She's not from Bolivia. She's from Sacramento, California. We met in Denver just coincidentally. We did some similar leadership training. At the end of that time, we thought, well, you know what? My wife is two-thirds of the way through a degree in biochemistry, and so she should probably finish that, because the way the American university system works is you can kind of dip in and dip out. Whereas I think I've never been to university in the UK, but I think in the UK, you kind of start the beginning of 3 years and you have to finish it, because if you don't, it's not so transferable, right, to a different...
I don't think it's as fluid as it is in the US based on what I've heard, but you can defer years, but it's a basically you defer and you start again from that year. So it's not... People don't do it. So
I ended up... My father-in-law's a pretty traditional American bloke that you would picture. He cuts the sleeves off of his T-shirts. He hunts. He has guns. Blah, 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 blah. So I did the traditional thing and asked him if I could marry his daughter. And he tells the story to this day that even though he was desperate to say no, he knew that his daughter wouldn't have liked him. So he just rolled with the punches.
Why was he desperate to say no? Because you was a limey? Is that what it was?
No, well, because he was worried that we were going to move to England and I had no money. I didn't have a job and I had no money. So how was I going to provide for his daughter? That was his main focus.
Is that a thing in America about how, that sounds quite traditional and sort of binary?
Yeah, it is binary. I don't think I can make a... I've got people around me. I think it's still traditional to ask the person's father for hand in marriage.
It's certainly traditional in the UK still, but it doesn't mean much more than it being tokenistic.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, my father.
But he was like, "No, you got to provide for my daughter."
Yeah. I mean, that's what came out afterwards. At the time, he just went very quiet and just said, "You know, yes, you can marry my daughter." And
what can he say?
I think even if he'd said no, we're still going to do it. So, you know, like you said, there's some tokenism there. So anyway, met my wife, and then we moved from Denver to back to Sacramento, California, so she could finish up her studies, because it seemed silly for both of us. For her to waste 2/3 of her education, and my mother, we got married around Easter, and so we did the good thing, and I went to Easter church with my in-laws because that makes them very happy. And I was wearing a Spurs shirt. I didn't know you were supposed to wear kind of a collar and a tie. What do I know? So I just rocked up in jeans and a Jamaican bow shirt.
Again, people that haven't listened to this that don't know.
Of course, mate. Yeah.
No. It's fine. Because it's interesting. Because I just want to know what Spurs shirt, what season you were wearing.
It would have been. It was the Kappa shirt.
No, 2005, Jamie Redknapp sort of era, bunch of
changes. Yes, exactly. That's
Jermaine
exactly
Defoe,
the one I was wearing.
Robbie Keane.
Yeah, banging. Yeah,
Casey Killer. There you go.
the false new dawn, but. Yeah, so I was wearing that, and then this bloke comes up to me and says, Spurs, your team. And it ended up being some bloke from Hemel Hempstead, who was also a Spurs fan.
Who'd happened to be in Denver as well.
No, this was back in California.
California,
but he was a football coach, and he was also there at church with his in-laws at Easter, because it's a traditional thing to do, and got to chit-chatting, and I said, I'm a fairly bold person and quite candid as a personality. And so I just said, do you have any leads on jobs? Because I've been back here a week and a half and I haven't found a job yet. And he's like, well, yeah, I work for a bank and I can get you a temporary job, at least to get a few pennies under your belt.
What was that?
So I worked, it was the bank that I started off in the mortgage industry with. But at the time it was just boring paper pushing for $13 an hour.
Because I feel like in my head there's narrative building here, and it's important to know what you were doing then and why you took that job.
It was in the mortgage department, because he happened to also work in the mortgage department. And so
you're not a young man who is desperate to work in mortgages.
Not in the slightest. Couldn't care less. I was a young man desperate to make some money to move out of my in-law's spare bedroom. Because we were living with, we were newlyweds, 21 and 22, living in my in-law's spare bedroom. And their spare bedroom had a shared wall with their bedroom. And I no more wanted to be in that room than they wanted me to be in that room. So I just...
Can I ask you, who was having more action in that instance?
Say it again.
Was it the in-laws or was it you?
Who's having more action?
Yeah. What bedroom was more lively?
I was 21. It's got to. I hoped and prayed that it was my bedroom.
The only one got to be really quiet. Just shh, everyone. Shh.
We did it more in the bathroom that with the shower on than ever since.
Which is why you needed your own place. It's why you needed to get out.
Exactly. So I ended up going into this, you know, I'm sure you've seen it. We call it Cubicle City. Just a big rectangle room with tons of cubicles. And there's people beavering away. And honestly, after about half an hour, I'm like, this job is so boring, but I've got, yeah. you know, I've got to stick with it. And, you know, my personality is like, you know, after a minute, I got up and started walking around. And at least in this office, and I think it's fairly common in sales environments in the US, that at the time they had whiteboards everywhere that had names and numbers and all the rest of it. So I just found the nicest looking face, the friendliest looking face that I could find, and asked and said, you know, I'm new here. I'm just interested. Could you tell me what these numbers mean? And the numbers on the board of people's names were how many mortgages they had done with clients and how the dollar amount of that mortgage. And then
so sales, much, it's like,
yeah, sales. Yeah. And how yeah. much money they were making. And I was 21. I didn't know anything about mortgage. I'd never bought a house in the UK. I had a current account with Nationwide. That was the extent of my financial escapades at 21.
Yeah.
And she told me, and I was like, well, hang on a minute. People call you and ask you to give them a mortgage. And she's like, yeah. And then when you give them the mortgage they ask for, you pay the person who happened to pick the phone up how much? And she said, yeah, that's pretty, you know, she's a bit more complicated than that, but that's exactly it.
And what were the numbers on this whiteboard?
Monthly between 5 and 100,000. And then annually between what, 50, 60 and a million.
And what year was this?
2006, end of 2006. So coincidentally, it's right at the beginning of the start of the collapse of the financial crisis that engulfed around, the world.
2007, 2008, is it? Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it started collapsing in 2007. If you've watched the film, what's the film?
The Big Short.
The Big Short. Yeah. That's exactly when I started in the mortgage industry. It's exactly that. And so I worked for a big bank that wasn't so involved in a lot of those, you know, kind of the... We didn't have TIPEX, or Americans would call it whiteout. We didn't have TIPEX and whiteout on our desks where we could fiddle the numbers to make it work. And we were a little bit more above board than that. But so I said to the lady who explained everything to me, I was like, well, I'm making, I think it was $12 or $13 an hour. I said, I want to do that. How do I do that? And she's like, oh, well, we happen to be interviewing in a couple of weeks' time. You know, work hard, blah, blah, blah. Well, so for the next 2 weeks, I worked hard at what I was doing. I got it done super early. That gave me an hour or two to wander around the office because I didn't really have a manager because it was a temp job. And I looked at the people's names who had the highest income. And then I went to talk to them about what they did and asked them. And most people were pretty polite, especially with having an accent. I think it's disarming. Yeah. And so they explained to me what they did. And then I asked people about how they got the job and what to say and what not to say in the interview. And so 2 weeks later, because they saw I worked hard, they gave me an interview. And then I fell into the mortgage industry, which I've not left since. And then
Matt,
so
you didn't get that interview because you didn't get the interview because of your accent. You got
no,
the interview because
was,
of your
I was forward. I was bold.
But you saw an opportunity, and this is I think people listening to this who might look at what you've got, and which is a big house, and as you said, an annex, and you know, you've got money and you've been successful, but when you flew to the US to be with you, or you flew to the US as a part of a charity and then met your wife and ended up living in the spare bedroom of her parents' house or her bedroom, wherever it might be, to where you are now is a massive success. And then
I mean,
it's
a classic American story, isn't it? I came to America with no money and I saw an opportunity and I strangled it with two hands. It's like, it's the American dream, as they call it, right?
Yeah, it is the American dream, but for some people. And
yes.
And it's for people who, there might be people listening to this who think, how has he fucking done that? Because that's not going to happen in my life. It's impossible. And what you've just said was that you saw an opportunity, or you was aspirational enough to ask questions.
Yeah.
You weren't a wallflower. You went out there and you was working a $13 an hour job, pushing paper around, doing some just nonsense that any idiot could do.
Yep, 100%.
But you saw something and thought, all right, I've got the gumption to ask that question to the right people. And I think if people I think people out there who might be listening to this, who want to succeed or want to take advantage of opportunities, it's when what you did.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Just act on something. Sorry, my dog's drinking again. Yeah.
No, carry on, Frank.
When it's the drugs he's on. But when you're, you saw the opportunity and you acted on it. Whereas I think a lot of people, myself included, for a long, long time, wouldn't have acted on it. It would be a good idea that I had in my head, but I don't do anything because I don't want to embarrass myself. I don't want to cause up people uncomfort or to feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing for me in those 2 weeks between when I figured out that that's what I wanted to do, and it was so crude. I just wanted to make money for my family, which I suppose is on brand. I wanted to provide for my wife at the time, and my father-in-law told me that once you get married, you pay for her education, and we couldn't get student loans at the time. And
let me bring you back here, yeah. Matt, because that doesn't compute in the UK. I don't know what that means. What? Why would you have to pay for your wife's education?
Well, it's just my father-in-law's traditional values. Well, my wife lived under his roof; she was his financial responsibility. And then when we got married, part of choosing to be married to his daughter is to choose to provide, and that was her going back to university. And here in the States, I think it's a similar in the UK, but you pay year by year or term by term, semester by semester here. And so I had to provide for my family. And in that 2 weeks, the best piece of advice I got given, and it got me through the interview, a lot of people will say, and I'm sure you've seen this on TV programs and stuff, and you know, like, here, sell me this pen or sell me that chair. And the best piece of advice I've ever been given, and I use it every single day to this day, whether that's with Mr. and Mrs. Smith who are buying their first home, or whether that's Mr. Tech Millionaire, the first thing I always do, you've got to ask questions. People go in trying to sell themselves, thinking that they just have to promote themselves or promote their product. And that advice that was given to me by a bloke called Adam in 2006 was just ask questions. And when you ask questions, you disarm. And you could do that literally everywhere. So you want to make a complaint because someone's upset you in a restaurant or on an airplane or in whatever. The first thing you do is, I always say, is this the service you would expect to receive? You go in like that and it disarms people. It's the same in selling anything. People come to me and like, well, what
not,
are you
I'm
looking
not sure
for?
I'm not sure I'd complain in the service industry. I don't think I'd do that. Certainly not to the person who's serving.
Right.
But the approach to ask questions is the correct one. Like, if you ever, I think Adam might have read How to Win Friends and Influence People. Have you ever read that?
Yes.
So this is a simple, essentially be like, fundamentally, I think that it gets a lot of sort of bad press because
it
sounds like it's about you know, being sort of business minded and business centric and making money. But fundamentally, in my opinion, what I got from the book when I read it was, it's just be good to people, be kind, be genuinely interested in them. Ask them questions. Like, if anyone's like going out for a date with a woman or a man or a a non-binary person, right? If you're interested in that person and you want them to like you, then you should be interested in them. And that's the same thing for business. It's like, how do you, like, people want to 100%. Be valued. They want to feel important. And if you make them feel important, then they're going to like you. But it doesn't. It's not just. It's not like lip service. It's, you have to be genuinely interested in them, I think.
Yeah, I think that's. I mean, people like talking about themselves, which is. I mean, maybe not everyone. I think people get a bit embarrassed and all the rest of it if they have any remote level of decorum. But yeah, asking people about them and then being genuinely interested and then trying and then remembering something about the conversation that you can bring up later on down the line. That's just a basic human skill, but. That's one of the things that, you know, I learned and I saw that opportunity and I've taken that principle throughout life. And, you know, I oftentimes with wealth comes a significant amount of narcissism because, I mean, that's just how it is. And so, you know, people like talking about themselves and it ends up helping people be successful. If they are nervous about what do I bring to the table and I couldn't possibly do what, you know, people who live the American dream have done. And a lot of it does come from the fact that I had a good education and a stable family life growing up. And I had interpersonal skills anyway. And I understand and appreciate a ton of the fact that there's some privilege in how I was brought up in that sense. And I capitalized on that. But, you know, what I do for a living is it's interpersonal skills.
Jump in there. I think I think anyone who is successful taps into something they were given, and that might have been something that was very difficult growing up. It might be something that was really easy and happy. It might be that you've grown up around five brothers. I think that the reason why I've been able to produce podcasts that people resonate with was that I grew up with five of my brothers and existing and being significant in a brother of five. That you had to have a certain element of understanding of what the other people were saying. So I had that, and in my formative years, that was sort of apparent around me all the time. And I think it's really served me as a grown up. But
well, I mean, like you started the fighting cock, and then with your mates, and then now you've made it as part of your business, right? Like there must have been some kind of point in all of that where you chose to grasp an opportunity. And seize on it. I don't mean it like
I understand what you're saying.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
but it was similar to when you were when you were looking around asking questions, right? In your job. So my moment of, you know, grabbing the bull by the horns, to use a horrible cliche, but was I had the idea to do a podcast or do something a long time, you know, much earlier than when it actually happened. And it was, I wanted to email Spooky, who's now become a very close mate, but back in then I didn't know who he was.
Everyone loves Spooky.
Yeah, he's great, he's amazing. But back then, he didn't know who I was, and I was just a pleb that read his blog. Like, I loved his blog, I loved it, and I just, like, I'd love to talk to him, but for me, that stage, I felt unable to, and then I was pissed up on a Friday night, and this idea about doing a podcast was resonating in my brain. I was thinking, oh fuck, I need to do something with this, but I don't know how to make it happen. And I emailed him when I was drunk, and that's often, it's not always a great thing to start reaching for the stars when you're drunk, but sometimes sometimes it works, and in my instance it did work. And I emailed him, and he was like, that sounds like a fantastic idea. Let's meet for a pint and talk it through. And you know, 11 years down the line, me and you are now chatting. because you listen to the podcast and I know your story, and that's how we're talking now. So the point, I guess, we're making here is that if you have an idea and it doesn't make you look like a wanker, actually, that's the wrong attitude, isn't it? Because sometimes you think your ego will make you believe that you will sound like a wanker if you suggest it.
Right.
But just be brave and be bold about what, if you have an idea you think is good,
yeah,
you should grab it. Or like you said, like in terms of there was an opportunity there. It's like, I don't want to be, earning $12 an hour and pushing paper around. Yeah. I want to do what people on the board are doing.
On that point, have you ever watched any TED Talks? Do you know what the TED Talks
are? Of course,
are?
Of course. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So there's one lady on there called Brené Brown, and she talks, it kind of ties into it. She's a doctor and lecturer at University of Houston in Texas. But she, like, a lot of her basis in life is we're humans are, like, very shameful people, and we don't talk about things because we're worried about shame. And if you can get to a point in your life where you can go beyond shame, elevate yourself. And that's not like that. And she, that can be applied to, everything. So if you people don't do things, don't take risks, don't step out, don't ask the girl out on a date or the boy out on a date or the non-binary person out on a date. They don't, because they're worried. They could have some shame. And so her whole premise is basically, as a psychologist, to get through life and get through feeling shameful about things. And then that also translates to not parenting with shame. Like with our kids, we don't, we never tell them, don't cry like a baby or don't cry like a girl, or we don't use shame phrases with our children. And it's,
man
a,
up,
it's the same
that kind
in
of
business.
Thing.
Yeah, exactly. And we, they're all based in shame. It's to create a behavior response from shame. But it's the same in business. It's the same in what
Absolutely.
You did. What held you back from talking to Spooky or acting on it before that? You got a little bit of Dutch courage, probably because you felt you might sound like a wanker to somebody that you really appreciated what they were doing in their blog.
Absolutely.
And you didn't want to be
100%.
And it's the same in my business. And it's the same in, a lot of people in terms of, I said I was bold and uncandid and I step out, but a lot of it is getting to a point where it doesn't really matter what people think. And being in that place is very, in terms of business, and it's very, very freeing. For me, I have a couple of nerdy tendencies. Like, people know that if they've, been around me, I have bees. Like, it's not very often that people who work in finance then have these little pottering hobbies that you would associate to old men. And when I first started getting bees, I didn't really tell people other than the people that walked past my house, because it was, and I thought, hang on a minute, this is super interesting. And I really like it, and it brings me relaxation. And so, just little things like that, remembering in my life, like, shame doesn't matter. Shame, care, like, honestly, who cares? Like, move past it.
Matt, I love this. I love this, and I want to talk about your bees in a second, because we'll round it up by talking about your bees. But there's something in that. Like, shame should be reserved for someone who's done something that is heinous or significantly wrong, or directly against a social objective or a goodwill or a general will in society. That you should feel shame. It's important, if you've done something wrong, that you should feel shame. But you shouldn't let 100%. Shame prevent you from achieving or doing something you think is good. Like that's the issue. And I think a lot of people do get caught up in that. Will I be humiliated if I ask a question? If I have an idea in my head and I go after it, will I be humiliated? The reality is that no, you won't. Or you may be rejected. It might not work out for you in that instance.
Right.
But you shouldn't feel shameful for that. The only time you should feel shameful is you're making someone else's life worse than it was before you showed up. That's the only time you should feel shame. But don't.
That's a great way to put it. I didn't even put those two things together myself. But yeah, when it was my wife who put me onto that TED Talk. And then I started intertwining it.
What was the name of it again? Just one more time.
Hopefully this doesn't mess up the app. It's a TED Talk by a lady called Brené Brown, Brene. And then the last word name is Brown. It's one of the top ever listened to TED Talks. And she's got,
she's got
a load of, if you got it.
Yeah. So it's TED Talk, Brene Brown.
Yeah, Brene Brown.
The
power
of vulnerability.
There you go. That's it. And being vulnerable means that you're not walking with a fear of shame. And we aren't vulnerable. And when people resonate with people that are vulnerable, a lot of the time. Yeah. And of course, they can get advanced. Yeah. So
because
anyway,
almost everybody feels vulnerable, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of a tangent, but that honestly, that's a lot of what, you know, being bold. I never ever told people how old I was when I first started working in the industry. I never told people that I didn't have any qualifications in finance. It was the classic fake it until I make it situation. And it was a lot of that was because of the shame. But then as soon as I choose to be vulnerable, yeah, it's super powerful. I recommend anyone to spend 15 minutes watching that TED Talk, which isn't why we first started talking in the first place, but it's pertinent to my story, I suppose.
I think it is interesting and it is pertinent because that you are significantly successful and you deal with people that are hugely successful. You know, talking about what you said, like between 5 million and whatever it was, 100 million pounds.
Ridiculous numbers. I've seen it a few times and just like that's beyond my comprehension.
But this, for what is abnormal to us or you, is normal to these people that you're serving. And then what you have on an intellectual level or an understanding is something different. It's what they need, which is why you end up making money out of it. But it all ties in. And what I think resonated with me when we started having this conversation, when we were chatting on the phone and whatnot, is that there are few. It's hard to explain to someone why what you've done has been successful. Like we often talk about, I often get asked like the Fighting Cock. It's a massively successful thing. Why, you know, how did that happen? It happened partly because we were lucky. We were very lucky at the beginning of the explosion of podcasts. We were there, so we were benefited from that. But the other thing,
I wore a Spurs shirt. You know what I mean? Like it is a lot of this stuff is.
You wore a Spurs shirt, exactly. It's luck.
Yeah.
You've got an opportunity, but it's about then recognizing the opportunities, and then I think like some people in the business world will go having the bollocks. Like being a man, grabbing the moment, all those cliches that aren't helpful. It's just about recognizing that there's an opportunity, and then being.
It's bold enough, honestly.
Bold enough, but not recognizing or grabbing hold of the shame that you're going to feel if you don't, if you do it and you're rejected. So why don't you ask the girl out that you see on a tube or the girl you fancy because she might reject you. So what? She rejects you in the exact same position as you are right now. But if she doesn't, she could become your wife and you live together forever.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, for me, I look at life and a lot of the decisions I make is I genuinely ask myself, well, what's the worst that could happen? What's the worst that could happen? The worst could happen is she says no or, you know,
we say that as men of a similar age where we kind of have that sort of ability to reflect. It's hard when you're 21. Although you did it when you're 21. Oh, mate, I wouldn't have had the bollocks.
I'm 37. I'm
40, and, so we're a similar age.
And so no, 100%, and it's something you learn as you get older. And I think you get to a point where you just stick the middle finger up and you don't care what anyone thinks anymore. And I
in
would
your 30s,
love
to, isn't it? Is it definitely in your 30s?
I would love to tell you that, but like still for me, like I find myself, like, for some reason, I lay in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning because, like you said the other day on one of the pods, you can't control what goes through your mind at 3 o'clock when you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I have the same thing. I deal with anxiety. I deal with mental health. Not, don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not the pit of depression. I don't want to belittle what other people.
Doesn't.
Yeah. And so when I deal with that, and when at 3 o'clock in the morning, you sit there and the anxiety of rejection. And I still deal with it. But I think at 37, you've had more experience to be able to then wake up in the morning, brush your teeth, comb your hair.
Yeah, that's it. When you get up,
go again.
All of the anxieties you had during the night aren't as significant.
Yeah.
Because you're brushing your teeth.
Ask that brain. Go. Why is it so? Why are things so much worse at 3 o'clock in the morning than they are at 8?
I don't know. they're almost life changing at 3 a.m. aren't they? They're like that's so true. Like, and I thought, like, I know it's not just me, but when and that's another thing about waking up at 3 a.m. and confronting all your demons is it feels like it's just you and you alone. and that your right. life, it's your body, your life that you're destroying, or your yeah. the people around you destroying. And then there is a million people at that yeah. moment going through the exact same thing and thinking the exact same thing. And then when you wake up at 8 a.m., things aren't as bad.
No, and there's some perspective that you have after a cup of coffee or morning tea or whatever it is that you have, that you end up not, you know, like you said, those demons aren't quite as insurmountable, and the stress isn't quite there, and the anxiety isn't quite as bad as it seemed at 3 o'clock in the morning. But it's one of those things where I end up, you know, for me, I have a significant, my job comes with a significant amount of stress, like a crippling, bring me to tears. Like last year, I almost packed the whole thing in. It wasn't worth it to me anymore. It was just so stressful.
So that's interesting. COVID. Like, you've been successful, but you've got to the point where you are successful and you have everything around you, and the pressure of it is sometimes insurmountable. Is that correct?
Oh, mate. Yeah. Honestly, sometimes why I escape to the Telegram group. I know that's not part of this other pod, but I have, and as silly as it sounds, like having that mindless banter or the mindless conversation about things that I don't necessarily talk about regularly, for me, significantly helped my mental health. Like last year, the impact of COVID in the American financial system was so deep. Like there were days where I didn't know if we would have the money to give the people that we promised to give them. And things wow. like that. And then the people are calling you. They've got their entire life in a movie.
Is that
van.
On you, Matt? Is that on you?
No, it's not, mate. But that's the level of anxiety and pressure that the expectation that's put on me. And that's one of my things I still learn to deal with. And so, yeah, I my wife last year plenty of times came to me and said, babe, my wife's a nurse. And she doesn't work, but she could work. And nurses in Northern California make more than enough money for us to feed our family.
Okay.
And she's like, I can go back to work, babe. Like, I can do that. Like, this is, you're killing yourself. With me, with stress, I ballooned in weight. And it was just very, very, the people were just assholes last year. I don't know if you noticed it, but like, everyone lost just basic manners. I couldn't believe it. And that, so even though it's successful, from a worldly perspective where, being able to pay your bills and not worry about things. Yeah. But last year was absolutely horrendous. And it bled into this year. And I promised myself, I actually got COVID in December. And my wife looked at me when I recovered and said, babe, that's the first 5-day stretch. You haven't answered a work telephone call in 14 years. People call me on Christmas Day. People call me on Thanksgiving Day. Maybe not Thanksgiving Day, but I'd answer emails at least on Thanksgiving Day.
What are they calling you about?
Well, they have, so it's people on those days, they have days off from their professional life. And so then the admin of their life asking me about, did we pay their council tax through on their mortgage? That's something that happens here with property taxes. You can pay in your mortgage. Asking me about, does it make sense to remortgage their house? They stop with their busy professional lives and they have some downtime, and that means that their minds start working, and then they reach out to me or people like me. I'm not the only one. There are thousands of people that do what I do. And so, it became, last year was absolutely unbearable. It was genuinely unbearable. I got through it, but that's not without work causing many, many tears.
Did the bees help you get through it?
100%.
Tell me about the bees.
So I built my own house. Like, I swung hammer and nail and built my own house over the course of like 2 years. And the guy who came in to do all of our tile and like countertops in our kitchen, he's a vegan dude. My daughter was 18 months old at the time, and he would come around, bring his food, and he'd sit my daughter down and feed her at lunchtime. To talking to him. He had 10 acres. He grew all his own food. He was basically self-sustainable, grew all his own food, vegetables, everything. And he bought me a jar of honey. And he said, hey, I produce this. Oh, that's really nice of me. Well, thank you. Ate the honey. And we live on an acre of land. And I read this book years ago called Dominion. And basically it was a thesis on humans should rid their life of all violence. So that means violence towards killing animals to consume them, violence like boxing, MMA,
any kind of violent act.
Any kind of violence. And so while I'm not a vegetarian, I had a moral conundrum on, like, how do I get violence out of my life? So one of the things I've done to get violence out of my life is rather than becoming a vegetarian, I've decided to connect with where my food comes from and understand the actual cost of the food that I consume. Not pounds and pence and dollars and cents, but the emotional cost of consuming the food, the physical toil that it takes to grow vegetables, make fruit. Well, anyway, so Emil gave me this honey, and I said at the end of it, well, bees are very important to pollination. If you don't have bees, there's not many things that, not other than bees, that pollinate.
We're all fucked, basically, without bees.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, you'd have bananas, because bats pollinate bananas, apparently. I learned last week, not bees. So we'd have bananas to eat, but we wouldn't have a huge amount of other stuff, and not in the volume that we need to consume. Long story short, I asked him if I could buy a bee. Where do you get bees? Is the first question. He's like, oh, well, you know, we have to kind of either catch them or you buy a hive from a beekeeper. And I said, well, can I buy a hive? So next thing I know, I gave him $500, and he brought two beehives over to my house and put them in the corner and said, there you go, there's bees. Well, for 2 years, I just let them do their thing. One day I went down there, one of the hives didn't have any bees left in it. So I was like, well, that's weird. Oh, whatever. So I took the honey and ate it and thought, oh, I felt very proud of myself. At the beginning of lockdown, my bank shut all the offices, so we had to work from home. On one day, my wife came up to me and said, babe, there's something wrong with the beehive. So I came out, and mate, there were, 50,000 bees. It was so loud, my neighbors came out of the house wondering what the hell was going on. Well, and the bees were doing this.
When you say there's something wrong with the beehive, what do you mean?
There wasn't anything wrong with it. My wife didn't know what the behavior was. And so what happened is the beehive was so healthy, they had too many bees in that space. And so the bees grow a new queen, because each hive will have one queen bee in it.
Right.
And then if they're healthy and they run out of space, they grow a new queen. The old queen takes about a third of the bees with her, and they fly away. It's called a bee swarm. You've seen like Winnie the Pooh or like these cartoons where these bees fly around in like a big cloud. Like, yeah. That's exactly what happened. So
in the air there was just thousands of bees.
Thousands and thousands. It was noisy, like not like an aeroplane taking off, but there was like this whir that I heard inside my house, and I came out and I was like, oh my god, what the hell's happening? And then so I ended up going on Facebook, finding a local beekeeping group, and said, took a video of it, and I was like, guys, I don't know what I'm doing.
I've got a problem here.
Yeah. And so they said, oh, that's a swarm. You should have given them more space in the hive. I'm like, well, it's too late now. They walked me
Would that mean just buying another hive for them to live in?
No, you buy more boxes.
Would two queens be able to live next to each other like that?
I mean, bee scientists can, but no, not typically. One queen bee would kill the other queen bee and be the queen of the hive. But so they talked me through it. To make more space in the hive, you know what a hive looks like, right? You're in a rectangle.
Yeah, of course.
Boxes,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, like so a tiny shed, a square shed.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. So inside that shed are what they call frames, and frames are where the bees make honeycomb. And in the honeycomb, they store honey, they store nectar, they store pollen, they lay eggs. It's like that's their house. Their frames are their house. Anyway, this group said, hey, get two metal bin lids and smash them together, and that messes with the bees' communication, and they will settle. They will find a branch on a tree and they'll settle there, and then they'll send out worker bees to go and find a new place to make a permanent hive. If you get them to settle, you can get the ball of bees, which genuinely looks like one of those Winnie the Pooh. It's like literally a big, massive clump of bees.
I've seen people on social media, like a bloke walking down the street with
the
queen in his hand, and then there's just bees all the way up. And they're not stinging him. He's just walking along with him. It's almost like he's moving that hive somewhere else.
Yeah. So what I did, you get a big bucket, cut a hole in the side. You make a temporary hive for them. as long as the queen bee, like you just said, as long as the queen bee goes inside, she releases a pheromone, and all the bees all the bees from her hive know her pheromone, and they follow that pheromone. So as long as the bee is inside that bucket, you've captured all those bees, and then you go get empty boxes, that shed, and then in the morning, you tip all the bees, you put a lid on the bucket overnight so they don't like being outside at night. Tip them in, and then you've got yourself another. So that's working from home. That was my first forced.
So what did you do with the
beekeeping?
So you hit the bin lids together. They settled, where did they go?
So I have a big bucket, and I put the bucket. I got on a bee jacket, and I climbed up a 20-foot ladder. And I don't like heights, so I climbed up.
Scooping them up.
Well, you put the bucket underneath. And I actually cut the tree branch. And so the bees fell a little bit, the little branch fell into the bucket. I put the lid on the bucket. So they were kind of, I say, trapped inside. There was a little hole that I cut on the outside. So the queen was inside. And then I left the bucket hanging there during the day. And then they started coming, going, like bees do in a hive. Yeah. And then at night, because bees don't fly at night, I covered up the hole.
They've all gone back into the bucket.
Yeah, because they follow the queen from the pheromone, and then in the morning I tipped them into that wooden shed, as you called it, the beehive, and then I went from having one hive to having two hives. Again, not knowing what I'm doing. That happened 5 times for one hive last summer. So
that's
I went
incredible.
From having one beehive doing nothing to having 6 beehives, and like all of a sudden having like a semi part-time job to look after them. But back to the mental health, bees are fascinating to me, and they're kind of the center of sustainable farming. And that's what I want on my acre of land. I don't want to necessarily grow all the food that I'm going to consume. But if I know where my kids' fruit and vegetables come from, we have chickens and ducks, and we get eggs from the chickens and the ducks.
Well, we have talked about chickens, haven't we, in the past? So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I, and the chickens eat all the table scraps. And then I dig the chicken poop into the vegetable garden, so I don't use any fertilizers, any chemicals in my vegetables, because I have the chicken waste to do it. And then the bees give me honey, so we don't buy sugar anymore. We just use honey for everything. And I make jams from the fruit that we have, and you can actually substitute sugar for honey in making jam. So I have, which is my nerd. This is my nerd side. But during the stress of everything, when I'm breaking down at work and I'm genuinely in tears and I don't know where to turn and I don't know how I'm going to solve all my problems, I'll go out to my bees and I'll do some maintenance inside, whether that's cleaning up the excess wax that they make, double checking that they don't have any diseases, that kind of stuff. And I just sit, honestly, like my wife has got so many pictures of me just sitting with a beer on a picnic chair, watching the bees just come and go. It's so mundane, but
that
because my work
sound
job is
stressful,
I just sit and watch it. Yeah, and so now I've learned about how important bees are to our ecosystem. And if people get nothing else from this pod, and I'm sure most people aren't even going to listen to the end of this pod, but the one thing anyone can do to make a better world for us to live in is stop using pesticides. Don't throw down, if you have a wasp nest, don't get a pest control person to come in and spray chemicals, because those chemicals don't differentiate between the wasps that you're killing, the flies and the bees, and the other flies will land on the pesticide, take it to a flower, leave the pesticide in the flower, a bee will get the pesticide because they collect pollen from the flowers, take it back to the hive, and that pesticide will kill the entire hive in a number of hours. Minutes, even. It's called hive collapse. So the one thing people can do is there's organic. Like all my neighbors around me, I go and give them all organic weed killer and pesticides every year. I take all of them, like 2 gallons of that stuff. Now, bees fly 2 miles away, so there's no such thing as organic honey unless it comes from the Amazon. But that's how I kind of try and make the world a little bit of a better place, by not allowing pesticides to kill the bees. And I just look watching how they communicate and how evolution has occurred like this. It honestly blows my mind that these little bug that stings us is central to our survival.
Bees don't really, do they? They're not aggressive.
No, honeybees are not, unless they're sick or you've really pissed. And when I say piss them off, like go up to the hive and shake it. Other than that, a bee that you see on a flower, all the bees that you see on flowers are female bees. They're not male bees, and the female bees are the only ones that sting you.
Are we talking about bumblebees as well? Like the
bumblebees aren't. Yeah.
Do you have them in the US? Like, you know, the big fat bumblebees, the ones with the big bum.
Yeah, we have these things called carpenter bees and wood bees, which are even bigger. They almost look like a hornet. And so, obviously, with my garden, I've got a bunch of flowers that are good for bees, and they forage. But a female bee, once she stings you, she dies. That's it. That's the end of her life. Mm. So she doesn't want to sting you any more than you want to be stung. It's only if she feels in danger. They're protecting the queen. Yeah, exactly. My kids, yeah. So it's one of those, just how, in a beehive, they kill all the males every winter. There's not a male bee in my beehive right now. They kill them all because the only thing males do in a bee population is eat their resources and mate with the queen. It's the only thing they do. So really? They kill all the males.
So not like, when you see sort of worker bees, when they go out, those are all females as well?
All females, always females. Male bees will fly about a bit, but they're not doing anything to help the ecosystem.
I don't know if this is true at all, but when I lived in London, European hornets were. Yeah. I'd never seen one. I saw one once in when I lived in London, and it absolutely blew my mind that a European hornet's head moves independent of its body. So bees and wasps, it's a two-part structure of their abdomen. This isn't correct, but there's the tail part, and then there's the head part with legs and stuff. But with European hornets, the head moves differently. It moves on its own, so there's almost three parts. And we had a hollowed out tree. It was essentially a dead tree. It's since collapsed, but we had a hornet's hive in this tree, and hornets are scary. Like if you're scared of wasps, you're going to be scared of hornets. Anyway, so there was this one night where hornets, they're attracted to light, like most of these insects, like moths and bees and stuff. They function during the day, but this hornet flew in through the kitchen door and landed on my chest, and I was screaming and running because I'm a lad from London. We don't see hornets, and certainly they don't land on your chest, and they cling to you, and they're so heavy that they pull your t-shirt down. They're that big.
Yeah, they're big. They're horrible. Sir. They're horrible. Horrible.
Yeah,
things.
But what I learned from reading up a little bit is that actually the hornets you're seeing flying around can't sting you, and they're certainly much less aggressive than typical wasps in England. But because they look
wasps
scary,
are horrible. I don't like wasps either. But people don't. I think we're just predispositioned. You hear a buzz and you flap.
I've
been stung 3 or 4 times. I mean, it's not pleasant. I don't like it. Just put an ice cube on it and you'll be totally fine, unless you're allergic to it. But it's one of the, just watching how all those insects move pollen around from flower to flower, plant to plant, and then we get food and we eat. And that, to me, like I said, just lets me, it relaxes me, it lowers my blood pressure. Yeah. I'm able to give, everybody loves to receive like a little jar of jam, a little homemade jar of honey. That type of thing. And it just, it brings some perspective to the bigger world of everything that I deal with on a daily basis, and people's ridiculous expectations of, can we have a phone call at 5? Yeah, we can have a phone call at 5. Oh, you meant 5 a.m. Yeah, I'll wake up, set my alarm, and go and find a quiet spot in my house to have a phone call with you at 5 o'clock in the morning, because you want to talk before you go to the airport for your important business meeting. Don't worry about it. Yeah, I'll wake up and impact my sleep pattern. Don't worry about it. So the bees are a central part of. I encourage everyone to have some, hobbies are so important, I think, and in people's mental health, it's everything about it fascinates me, blows me away.
Okay, mate. I mean, I think that's a nice way to end this. We've talked about opportunity, we've talked about money, we've talked about having money and not having money. We've talked about how bees can save, or at least help, or ameliorate someone's mental well-being. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Matt. This has been a really interesting conversation.
I appreciate you reaching out, and I'm desperately hoping that this doesn't come across as a narcissistic mess. I know I've said that before, but I've enjoyed the chat. This honestly, this type of thing helps my mental health, just having a chat. I know you're essentially a stranger, but this type of thing, talking, helps so much, and just being able to wax lyrical about the bees and stuff. Thanks, man, for reaching out. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Cheers, Matt. Nice one, mate. All right,
mate.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cheers, bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.